Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 11th of March, these are our main stories. Pope Francis is facing a barrage of criticism over his comments suggesting Ukraine should consider itself defeated and should negotiate an end to the war with Russia. The Saudi king has used his Ramadan message to call for an end to what he described as brutal crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Also in this podcast,
we hear the shooting 2 weeks ago. I had children who had to be flat on their stomach under the benches. The shooting was so heavy in the classrooms.
As gang violence gets worse in Haiti, we hear from people in one of the slums in the capital, Port-au-Prince. It's not the first time that Pope Francis has been criticised for his remarks on the war in Ukraine, but the head of the Roman Catholic Church has sparked fresh controversy by suggesting that Kyiv should negotiate with Moscow after more than 2 years of war following Russia's invasion of the country. The Pope's comments were in an interview recorded last month but released on Saturday. In that interview, the Pope said the strongest one is the one that looks at the situation, thinks about the population and has the courage of the white flag.
The word negotiate is a courageous word. When you see that you are defeated, when things are not going well, you have to have the courage to negotiate. One may feel shame, but how many dead will the war end up with? One should negotiate in time, find a country that can be a mediator.
The Vatican spokesperson has clarified his remark, saying the Pope didn't mean to suggest that Ukraine ought to surrender to Russia, but instead was calling for a ceasefire. But Alexei Goncharenko, a Ukrainian MP from the southern port city of Odessa, said the Pope should condemn Russia.
If you want to comment something, you should know about this. Like, I just would like to invite him to Odessa or to Bucha or to Kiev or to Kharkiv, and probably after this to comment. There is a need to condemn the genocide which Russian Federation is committing against Ukrainians. For us, white flag means that they will kill all of us. They're killing Ukrainians on occupied territories. And we want peace more than anybody in the world, because we want peace, which doesn't mean just to destroy all of us, to kill all of us.
In addition, Poland's Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski said the Pope should encourage Russia to withdraw from Ukraine. A correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse, had more on Ukraine's response to the Pope's comments.
Well, I mean, if you go on what Dmytro Kuleba, the Foreign Minister, is saying, there are thought to be around a million Catholics in Ukraine. But in short, no. When you look at the kind of complex geopolitics around this, where you have Europe, the European Union and Western allies frantically trying to work out how or even if they can plug a sizable gap in terms of military support, which is being left by the US as a sizable package there, continues to be blocked by political disagreements in the US Congress. So I think those are the major stakeholders which Ukraine will rely on when it comes to continuing its fight. But nevertheless, the Pope is a hugely significant, influential figure. He has talked about wanting negotiations in the past, but despite all of the frustrations it is having at the moment, it still sees fighting as being its only choice in this existential battle. And suggestions of otherwise, not least surrendering or doing the courageous thing in the words of Pope Francis, to wave the white flag, it's still seen as deeply unpopular politically.
But are they worried that the Pope coming out and saying this might be a sign that support for Ukraine in the West is weakening, that the Pope is saying what others actually think, even if they're not saying it publicly?
Of course, there'd be that sensitivity, you'd imagine. But I think, you know, I think Ukraine knows there is this fatigue that is directly hampering its soldiers' ability to fight. There is these minority of Republicans that are hugely influential, which are blocking the ammunition and equipment Ukraine so desperately needs. You had that that prank call for the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, where she conceded privately that there was a fatigue with Western allies. But at the moment, what it needs, I think, or what it's hoping for, is some kind of progress to present to Western allies, to say, look, keep backing us. But President Zelensky's acknowledged. He said, look, it's easier to support a country or a person when they're winning.
And James, you're there. What is the latest on the fighting on the ground? Are Russian troops advancing?
They are. And, you know, we talked a lot, didn't we, about the fall of this town called Avdiivka a few weeks ago, somewhere that Ukraine feels that it should never have really let go of. And it seems that Russia isn't stopping there. The Ukrainians are struggling to establish a fallback position, a new front line, and Russia is making its size count. And we're seeing more villages being taken, more settlements. The eastern front line, while broadly static, is starting to erode for Ukraine. And it puts cities like Kostantinivka, Kupiansk, for example, in really difficult positions. It's incredibly difficult for Ukraine at the moment.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. With the beginning of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, there's intense focus on what happens in Gaza. Now, the Saudi king, King Salman, in a speech read by a government minister, has characterised the situation there as a brutal crime. It comes on top of criticism of Israel's conduct of the war from the US President Joe Biden. And with the continuing failure to reach a ceasefire in the conflict, civilians in Gaza are struggling to access food and clean water. Dominic Allen is from the UN Population Fund in Rafah.
I think the situation is beyond catastrophic. What I saw broke my heart. My takeaway was that Gaza is dust. The looks in the eyes of the people as we drove through and then we got out and we spoke to them, the emotions are truly, they're indescribable. Everyone we passed, everyone we spoke to was asking for food because every day is a battle for survival in the north. One quarter of Gaza's population is one step away from famine.
But despite the international criticism, there's little let-up in Israel's offensive. Here's Boaz Bismuth, a member of the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. He's from Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party.
We are at war against terrorism, not against Gaza civilians. And any aid that comes to civilians, we don't say no. Yet, there is one thing that I must say. If by any chance this aid coming by the EU, by the United States, by any country you can mention, any organization, any institution, if the Hamas is involved in distributing this aid, this will be a big failure from Israel.
And efforts are increasing to get aid into Gaza. The US has conducted another airdrop and a US Army logistics ship has left Virginia en route to Gaza to establish a temporary floating pier. Another ship, towing a barge with 200 tons of food aid for the territory, is to depart from Cyprus. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville has more on that vessel.
There's about 150 to 200 tons of aid on board, and it has everything from flour and rice to pre-prepared meals and water. It's quite a long journey. It's 210 nautical miles. Normally that journey from here in Larnaca to Gaza would take about 15 hours, but because they're pulling that big, heavy barge, it might take longer. And the organisations involved have said a number of times the most difficult part of the journey will be the last mile, because landing in Gaza will be very difficult. It doesn't have a functioning port. And of course, in parts of Gaza, all law and order, all civil society really has broken down since Israel's bombardment and ground invasion. And the need from the people in Gaza is absolutely desperate. So there is always that danger that when this ship appears on the horizon and gets closer to shore, that people will start making their way towards it, will enter the water. We've seen some pictures from World Central Kitchen, which is one of the charities involved, which seems to show a temporary pier being built inside Gaza. There's heavy lifting equipment, large boulders and rocks are being moved towards the foreshore to make way for the preparation for when this ship finally gets underway and starts that journey.
Quentin Somerville. Hundreds of protesters in Amsterdam have demonstrated against Israel's military operation in Gaza at the inauguration of a museum commemorating the Holocaust. The demonstrators demanded the arrest of the Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who was at the ceremony, accusing him of complicity in genocide. Here's our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard.
The inauguration of the Dutch National Holocaust Museum could hardly have come at a more charged time. Looming over events was the shadow of the Gaza conflict. A diverse crowd of protesters, a number of them Jewish, gathered nearby to denounce the invitation of President Herzog. "Jews against genocide," read some placards. Demonstrators chanted a phrase deployed later, but in a very different sense, by Mr. Herzog.
Never again is no! Never again!
There were calls for Mr. Herzog to be arrested and judged at the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
The prosecutor of the ICC, this is your job. It is your job to make sure that the president of Israel is being arrested today.
Many protesters emphasised they were not demonstrating against the museum itself. It commemorates those killed in the Second World War by the Nazis during an occupation that lasted from 1940 to 1945. The vast majority were Jewish, but some victims were Roma and Sinti. Three-quarters of Dutch Jews were killed, more than 100,000 people, most after having been deported to concentration camps. It was a higher proportion than any other occupied country in Western Europe. The Dutch king, Willem-Alexander, spoke at the main ceremony in a synagogue near the museum, attended by Holocaust survivors and their relatives. He said the new institution was about more than recounting the stories of those murdered and cut loose from society decades ago.
Het is aan ons allemaal om te voorkomen dat antisemitisme.
It is up to all of us to prevent antisemitism from leading to a hurricane that blows away everything we hold dear. Let us never forget the Nazi Sobibor concentration camp in Poland started here in our Vondelpark with a sign, Jews forbidden. There is no excuse for ignorance.
Mr. Herzog made similar remarks.
This institution sends a clear, powerful statement. Remember. Remember the horrors born of hatred, anti-Semitism and racism, and never again allow them to flourish. Unfortunately, never again is now, right now. Because right now, hatred and anti-Semitism are flourishing worldwide.
The Israeli president also called for the immediate release of Jewish hostages being held by Hamas in Gaza. Lyrics from a Dutch singer-songwriter who played at the ceremony, Douwe Bob, seem to have echoes of a polarised day.
These are bittersweet days, and it's hard if you don't know, child. These are bittersweet days.
Afterwards, the king was booed when he arrived at the museum itself for a tour. Outside, tensions rose. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators berated a smaller group of people waving Israeli flags. Some also climbed on and jostled police vans. Officers responded with tear gas. A day that should have unified people left many on both sides with a bitter taste in the mouth.
Danny Eberhard reporting. As we record this podcast in London, in Los Angeles, nominees for this year's Oscars are nervously waiting to find out who has won this year's awards as the ceremony gets underway at the Dolby Theatre in Hollywood. One of those waiting for his category to be called is the sound designer on the film The Zone of Interest, which is also vying with movies like Oppenheimer and Barbie for the prize of Best Picture. The British film was shot almost entirely within the walls of the home of the camp commandant at Auschwitz. The power of the film lies in the contrast between the cosy, flower-filled existence enjoyed by his family and the horror of the death camp next door, a world evoked entirely through sound. Johnny Byrne has been nominated for the Academy Award for Best Sound, and he told us how he'd approached the job.
I read all the available literature that you can find in bookstores and and online, and you know, testimony and Nuremberg trials and so on. And we also had access to the Auschwitz Museum Memorial Archives. My approach was just to obviously make a record of anything that, where there was a direct reference to what something may have sounded like the roll call bell, you know, 4:30 in the morning in summer, and the sound of the electric fence and things like that. But also gathering testimony of events that obviously would have had a sound to them, torture and beating, and trying to work out from the many, many accounts specifically what that would sound like.
One that is a constant leitmotif is gunshot, people being executed, is what you certainly imagine. Can you just tell me what you did to make sure that was authentic?
The camp was a place of mass murder, but even by gunshot alone, there were like 80 to 90 executions per day at Block 11. I had a map of Auschwitz, and I had to understand all the way that sound would travel over distance and the refractions and reflections of the buildings and how that sound would travel to the garden. We understood and we learned that the guns that they used for execution were the First World War guns, because the modern stuff was on the front line. So we got hold of the right guns, and we found a firing range on the Isle of Wight where we could record with a similar kind of acoustic to it and at the right distance.
I think you also used the sound of football supporters and indeed of French rioters.
That's right. You know, the film does feel so realistic, and it felt kind of somehow the wrong thing to do to get a bunch of actors in a room in Soho and say, pretend this is happening to you. And it just felt far more appropriate to go and travel around Europe. Young German men shouting is something you can go and find. The Parisian riots was an opportunity for us, which sort of suited the narrative that during this period, many of the train arrivals were actually from France. Yeah, distressed French voices were available there.
There's also a sort of mechanical sounding groan in the background a lot of the time.
I mean, we kind of see that as the soil of the camp. The camp was a place for enormous industry, you know, armament manufacture, textiles. There was also the crematoria, and there were mass movements of people. That sound is an amalgamation of most of the things that I found in my learnings, basically.
Can I ask you a final question, a personal question, personal for me rather than you? But I bought the Martin Amis book that it's loosely based on when it came out. And after a while, I stopped reading it because I felt awkward about the fact that this terrible event that we know quite a lot about factually was being fictionalised. Do you think it was right to make the film, I suppose, is the question?
Well, I think in a world where, you know, there is still so much pain happening and these things could happen again, I think it's absolutely right, isn't it, to retell the story. And I think so long as you aim to do that with as much sensitivity as possible, it certainly felt, for me, the right thing to do, to be a part of it, yes.
Oscar nominee Johnny Byrne talking to Edward Sturton. Still to come,
he has a vision of a monumental chocolate fountain which spirals down the length of a room and puddles at the bottom.
The Premier of the Australian island state of Tasmania has promised to build the world's largest chocolate fountain if he's re-elected. As we record this podcast, it's being reported that EU diplomats have left Haiti, the Caribbean country where gang violence following a mass jailbreak at the beginning of March is getting worse. Essential US embassy staff were airlifted out of the country on Sunday as a state of emergency in Haiti was extended and gangs stepped up their calls for the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, to step down. With the main roads out of the Haitian capital closed and police officers confined to the port, airport and key ministries, a senior UN official in the city has warned of food shortages. Philippe Blanchard is chief of mission for the International Organization for Migration.
For months already, food has been an issue with inflation and difficulty to reach access to food. But with the looting of the port and the fact that the airport also is no more operational, it is anticipated that, yes, food will be a big problem in the coming days.
Sister Paisy is a French nun who spent the past 20 years living and working with children in an impoverished area of Port-au-Prince called Cité Soleil. James Kumarasamy spoke to her.
These past few days, the streets in Port-au-Prince have seen a lot of violence, which is different from the violence that was already there before. Because in the past years and months, gangs were fighting with each other, against each other. But in the past few days, they have united with each other in order to fight against the government institutions. When the gangs were fighting one against the other, the fighting was mostly in the poor area, in the slum areas. But now this has been taking place in other parts of the city around government institutions. They even tried, like the day before yesterday, they tried to take over the National Palace. They failed because the police fought them back.
What has that meant for you and the people that you work with?
The people I work with are mostly children. We have homes for children who had been on the streets. So these homes are running. We had difficulties like to get water and food for the past few days because of this violence and the barricades in the streets. But yesterday, Saturday, so we were able to get water for the homes. And then we also have the children in the schools. These are located inside the slum areas, so which had been calm over the last few days. So we were able to continue working in our schools.
And in the longer term, what are you expecting? I know a senior UN official is saying, who's in the city, saying there are concerns that if the violence continues and gets worse, that will have an impact on the ability to get access to food and water.
Yes, and the longer term, it's really difficult to foresee what will happen. And I can say, like most of the people here, very much living one day at a time. People from the international community send messages like they have to organize election as soon as possible. But this shows a lack of knowledge of the reality here, because the country has to be pacified and stabilized before there can be any election. It's a total chaos. So there is, to my point of view, there is no way elections can be organized properly soon.
You have experienced a lot over the last few years yourself. Are you still feeling able to do the work you do? Are you still feeling confident to stay there?
Well, in my case, it is a mission. I feel the Lord is asking me to do what I can to protect those children, and the children are there. I mean, they hear the shooting. The last 2 weeks ago, I had children who had to be, for a good while, flat on their stomach under the benches. The shooting was so heavy in the classrooms, so they are very much aware. Do they think about their future? Maybe the teenagers, when they grow up, yes, but children tend to be more in the today and just be children and play and do their schoolwork when they can.
Sister Paisy in Haiti. After being absent from the public eye since Christmas, the first official photo of Catherine, Princess of Wales, has been published on social media. The princess has been recuperating at home at Adelaide Cottage near Windsor Castle following her admission to hospital for planned abdominal surgery. The photo, along with a message thanking people for their support, was released to mark Mother's Day here in the UK. Our royal correspondent Daniela Ralph has more.
We hadn't actually seen the Princess of Wales in public at all since Christmas Day, when she was at Sandringham with the rest of the royal family. A couple of weeks after that, she went into hospital for this abdominal surgery. And since then, we have heard very little. And what that has done has created a bit of a vacuum of information that has been filled by some wild speculation. So her team around her will be hoping that the release of this photo today, this informal image of her sitting in jeans surrounded by her three children laughing, will do something to quell some of that speculation and curiosity about what's wrong with her and how her recovery is going.
Because it has gone rife on social media in particular, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been absolutely wild. In the past couple of weeks, prompted, I think, by her husband, the Prince of Wales, Prince William, not turning up to a Thanksgiving service in Windsor to give thanks for the life of King Constantine of Greece, who was his godfather. When he didn't show up to that, it just seemed to open up social media and online searches totally to lots of crazy, wild rumours about what's wrong with her, where she is, what she could be having done, what's going on. And that has put Kensington Palace, who look after the princess, under quite a lot of pressure to say something. Every Mother's Day, as it is here in the UK today, she usually actually does issue a photo and a message. So it was a neat solution today for them to release something.
I think the problem, though, many people will think is the contrast between saying nothing and the openness about King Charles' health.
Yes, there are two very different strategies going on here between the two palaces. For Buckingham Palace, they made that early decision to go quite public with details of King Charles's condition, although they haven't told us exactly what cancer he has. So there is still quite an important piece of information that is being held back. But I think the difference in terms of Buckingham Palace is that King Charles is the monarch. His constitutional duties that he is still trying to fulfil to a degree, and they want the public to see him doing that work. The palace, Buckingham Palace, want to show him at work. There isn't that same pressure on the Princess of Wales. She doesn't have that constitutional pressure to show that she's doing something. And her team are very focused on her privacy, because that day that we see her again for the very first time carrying out a royal engagement will be a day of intense scrutiny. And they don't want to put her out in the public spotlight again until she's totally ready.
Daniela Ralph. As we record, exit polls in Portugal's election are predicting a victory for the opposition centre-right Democratic Alliance. Issues dominating the campaign included a crippling housing crisis, low wages and struggling healthcare. Alison Roberts is in Lisbon.
According to one exit poll, the Alliance may have secured as much as 4 percentage points more of the vote than the Socialists, while another put them all but neck and neck. Either way, it's a big turnaround from 2 years ago, but not enough to give the Alliance a majority in Parliament. Its leader, Luís Montenegro, has publicly ruled out doing deals with far-right Chega, which has more than doubled its vote. Portugal's long-serving president, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, is to call all parties with seats in for talks one by one in the coming days. With the rise of the far right a major focus during the campaign, voter participation was several percentage points up on the last two legislative elections.
Alison Roberts. And finally, a sweetener. Let's end this podcast on the pure pleasure of chocolate, as depicted in the film Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The film has a chocolate waterfall and river, and the eccentric Willy Wonka reveals his world view, one of a planet dominated by chocolate. Now, one politician in Australia has been channeling this energy, declaring that if he's re-elected later this month, he will build the world's largest chocolate fountain. For more on this grand plan, here's Stephanie Prentice.
It really has it all. We've got excited Tasmanian Liberal politicians, we've got a budget of millions of dollars, and we've got dreams of rivers of molten chocolate. So what is this? Well, Jeremy Rockliff, he's the current Premier of Tasmania, a place where there's already this huge Cadbury chocolate factory. Actually, it's the largest in the Southern Hemisphere. So in many ways, already the Willy Wonka of Australia. And perhaps inspired by those waterfalls of chocolate inside the factory in the Roald Dahl Willy Wonka universe, he has a vision of a monumental chocolate fountain which spirals down the length of a room and puddles at the bottom. So this vision, yes, there are artistic images already, is huge glass windows overlooking the water with this giant chocolate fountain cascading away in the background. He says it's going to draw tourists from all around the world to Tasmania to experience his new chocolate wonderland and become part of the must-see things to do there, which he lists as hugging a Tasmanian devil, friendlier than they sound, sipping wine and climbing Cradle Mountain. And we know that driving tourism is a key part of his plans for the island.
How feasible is this grand plan?
Well, the current largest fountain is in... Actually, have a guess. Where do you think it is?
I would guess the United States. Am I right?
I would have. It's actually in Austria, in the north, in this very fancy chocolate shop and museum. It's called the Confiserie Wenschitz, and it's 40 feet tall. So what's that?
Wow.
Three-story house?
Yeah.
It's pretty big. Wow. That one is quite artistic. You can't actually eat it, though. It's kind of there for vibes only. Mm. Whereas Jeremy Rockliffe's plan seems a bit more fun. He wants his fountain to sit alongside a new chocolate lab and playground where people can make their own bars, they can interact with the chocolate. Now,
His big stumbling block in getting this done might be that some have said his vast budget could be used elsewhere for things like healthcare. I mean, the initial pledge is $12 million. It could go up to $100 million if the huge expansion happens. But much like Willy Wonka before him, who, as you remember from the book, had little care for the outside world and things like even workers' rights or child safety, Jeremy Rockcliffe is determined. He says the fountain will create jobs, boost the economy, and he's also spoken quite passionately about the absolute joy of touring the old Cadbury factory and coming home with pockets full of chocolate. So as political statements go, that one is pretty hard for anyone to disagree with.
What happens if children fall in?
I think that's up to Jeremy.
Stephanie Prentice talking there to Alex Ritson. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.